Transylvania, the jump. 5% of the population, with 40% of the wealth of all nations. We sit on top of our towers of steel and gold. The streets are burning up and they've been sold out.
Right. good evening one and all, and a very warm welcome to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. It seems at last we've got everything working. There's been a fair amount of difficulty one way and the other over the last few weeks, but I think we should now be back in position regularly. Plenty of things lined up. Tonight's show is becoming a bit of a tradition, really. It's a Fire in the Mountain special, because the Doctor and Synchro spent the last week or so, 7 or 8 days all told, out near Aberystwyth in the hills at a beautiful old farm, raising straw with a bunch of people who've really become quite good friends over the last 2 or 3 years. This was Fire in the Mountain's 4th year. We've been there for the last 3 years, and as we'll hear in the various interviews, the place has progressed, as has the event, the organisation, and everything. Well, the last track you heard there was Kidnap Alice, Chilly Winds, from their first album, which I think was released in 2012. Kidnap Alice was the reason why we went out to this festival to start with, knowing that they played there regularly, and having seen them at the abysmal Secret Garden party that I went to, I really fancied seeing them again. So we volunteered for the crew, which is what we do there. Before that, there was a band called the John Preston Tribute Band, who I'm going to be returning to in a moment or so. That's the title track of their album called Ruling Class, which was released last year. I got a bit of an interview with John Preston because he's a very, very entertaining man, and the band were great. I really enjoyed them. Before that, Sheila Nagig, Lost in Transitvania, from their album, which is called Circa Insomnia, which also came out in 2013, as far as I can gather. And there'll be more Sheena and a gig later on. They played an absolutely blinding set. And before that, you heard the Fire in the Mountain, or Tan Unna Munnydd, Sea Shanty Choir, doing Blood Red Roses. More of the Sea Shanty Choir later as well. But I think we've got 2 or 3 interviews to fit in, and lots of music tonight, because I really wanted to try and skip across the surface of the variety of stuff we heard this year. But now we'll move into the first bit of chat, which is a conversation I had with John Preston, who's the bass player in his own tribute band, and Carol, who is the astounding keyboard player for the same. This particular interview happened in a nice yellow and red tent just outside the Moringa Cafe, and opposite the family area at the festival. I was hoping to get an interview with Mel, but didn't get time. She was the lady who was organising all the children and the small people, so you'll be able to hear them singing. They get a bit noisy at times, but I think the interview is still pretty clear. So here's the first of tonight's talky bits, in amongst all the music, a chat between Dr. Rock and a man he discovered wearing a t-shirt which said compliance is death. I'm here with John Preston and Carol, keyboard player from the John Preston Tribute Band. Thanks very much for agreeing to join me for a bit of a chat.
Well, thank you for asking us.
Well, man in compliance is death t-shirt meets man with legalised freedom t-shirt. Do you think we're going to find any common ground at all?
I think we already have yesterday. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely astonishing set. We'll certainly be playing quite a lot of your songs on the show as time goes by.
Oh, please do.
You've clearly got a form. How did you work your way up to being, you know, head of your own tribute band?
Well, actually, it was a shortcut, really. You know, at the age of 54, there's no time to do all the playing endless toilets for 2 years and working up a cult status, so we just went straight to forming our own tribute band to cut out the rise, the success, the collapse and the infamy. Well, we just go and just run our own tribute band to ourselves.
Good idea. And what did you done in the run-up to this? How have you played with others, and because you've clearly got a lot of some experience?
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, for me, I've plonked on a bass since I was 18, 17, you know, with that classic hit, the Sniffing Blue magazine. Don't you remember? Here's one chord, here's a second chord, here's a third chord, now go form a band. and it was actually, it's a cliche, but it was very liberating. It meant I could play a bass. I didn't get music before then in terms of how I would learn an instrument, even though my dad was a jazz trombone player. And so I plonked about, and then I did a music degree in my 30s. In the end of my 30s, I met Carol, who was a music therapist, and she was my supervisor. And she's a classically trained pianist.
Right.
My supervisor.
And it's brought you to John Preston's tribute band. You were even introduced as John Preston.
It brought me to John Preston first, and then the tribute band.
So how long have you been cracking at this?
I think not very long, actually, as... I would see Ruling Class as our first proper album, actually. I think we were just finding our way for a couple of years before then. Didn't have that much time to play together. So since Ruling Class, I think we've been...
We were a pop-up band. So for about 3 years, we've been... You know, we had spent a year recording that CD, but before that, we were a bit like a pop-up band.
Yeah.
So we'd do a one-off gig... We recorded an EP called Reduced to Clear, and then we recorded a single called No Incinerator, which was local to King's Lynn, where there's now been a massive campaign against a waste incinerator that an American company wanted to build in King's Lynn, and we won, not just this band, but the King's Lynn anti-incineration campaign won, and, you know... We put an album together with a load of musicians called Smoke on the Wash. Oh, that was really cool. And apparently UKIP are now taking praise for the beating the incinerator, which shows what a bunch of slime bags they are.
Yes, yeah, quite so. Just a different coloured slime bag, basically. But isn't that what they're so good at? Taking the credit for other people's work and failing to take the credit for their own.
Yeah, that's a good point, isn't it?
Debit.
Yes. Yeah, quite so. So yeah, I mean, I really like the lyrics to your songs as well. With the clear case, non-compliance. Have you always been that way inclined, or is it just the increasing madness of the world that's driven you to it?
I think an increasing sense of clarity has helped me finally coordinate words. You know, I guess. Carol introduced me to the joys of sitting still quietly and not taking drugs and drinking so much. And reading things like Noam Chomsky actually was a huge relief.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
It kind of expands a little, doesn't it?
Well, it just tells you the way things you thought. I thought it was like this. And now I understand what they tell you about on the news, but it's always confusing when you listen to the news. You never quite get the bottom of it, but sort of Chomsky and people just tell you everything if you've got the patience.
Yeah.
So that was a huge relief to find him.
So the opening up and expression of all of this is really quite new to you.
You've been writing songs for quite a while, actually. Yeah. I think it's... And you've been kind of finding... ways on your own with your guitar, but I think actually since we got together, that's been not you and me, but the four of us in the band, that's been really where there's a much fuller kind of working and expression of the words that you jot down endlessly.
Yeah, but actually being able to have somebody to try them out on, like Carol, who then actually says that's bogus. No, John. No, you're not singing that, are you? And punctuation really helps.
Yeah. God, supervisor, I told you, I'm stuck in the role.
Carol is the musical director of the band as well. Okay. That's very important to know.
I guess has to be given a bit of that. And how did you come across Les, the drummer? Because he's quite an extraordinary artist.
He's like the band's guru, I think, Les. Known Les for about 15 or 20 years, just sort of working, scratching away in Norfolk, doing workshops, music workshops and stuff. Les is an engineer, he plays percussion, he's a guitarist, and actually his patience in terms of sitting and listening to people when recording for a long time, just listening and then just being able to feedback stuff very kindly.
Yeah. I think that's a really major point. I mean, I do community drama at the Living World Theatre Company, and the people we've been working with them now for 10 years, and they never criticise.
Yeah.
They always draw stuff out of people positively and gently without upsetting them, which I think is a fantastic skill.
Yeah. Or actually, what Les is really good at, actually, is, and I've seen it also when we were recording the Smoke on the Wash album with all sorts, we recorded about 9 artists in 2-3 hour sessions, and a friend of ours who plays lots and lots of notes, Les can just wag his finger and go, no, no, yes, and he gets it, and we got this really nice piece of music out of him, you know, so he's sort of like, he just knows where to sort of confine people in a really helpful way.
Yeah,
you know,
and he has long experience.
Yes,
really great. You need a bit of that in sitting in the corner and having it on the drum kit. It's actually quite useful, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Stability,
yeah,
where you actually need it.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, we've got 2 engineers, because Mark's an engineer as well.
The guitarist, so, yeah.
Off working with Dr. Feelgood this weekend.
Yes.
As you said, the meal ticket plus £1.50 didn't quite cut it today.
Yeah, although I'm going to make him regret he didn't come, because I think he'd have loved it, actually.
What are your impressions of the festival? I mean, what do you think of Fire in the Mountain 2014?
Carol.
No, you've got the ready words, I haven't. Go on.
Have you?
Yeah. Go on. I'm too tired.
You're too tired.
It was a hell of a night last night, wasn't it?
It's too tiring. It's actually really beautiful. I haven't been to any festivals for years. I used to sort of sell rags at things like Glastonbury and Roskilde Festival in Denmark. But actually, like, walking down to the shower at midnight and having a warm shower by the river's beautiful, and the main stage area is really, people have put a lot of love into making the site very beautiful. And then you get your usual endless all night drumming, homeless people around the campfire, bottles of whiskey stuck to their chins.
Yeah. Definitely the no glass rule has not managed to sustain itself.
Yeah. It's not been too bad though, but no. Yeah, it's really not. And just some really good music, actually.
That's one of the things I love about this, is that there's musicians everywhere as well. It's not just on the stages, there's musicians in the woods and in the fields, and, you know, you get to see people do like an amplified set, and then get to find them hanging out somewhere doing an unplugged.
Yeah, I think you'd really like Dark Patrick. I'll put a plug in for Dark Patrick.
Okay.
I think you would like them, because like they when we heard them, they do some songs like Cream of Society in Ukrainian.
Yes.
Cream of Society, I am opposed to you.
Yes.
It's great, with hurdy-gurdy and synths. Yeah. It's really good.
Well, yeah. I mean, with songs like, Ruling Class and Riot for Austerity are 2 of the names I remember, but I remember actually just looking at your little track listing and thinking, well, they all sound great, they do. How do you find it's going down? Do you get to play a variety of venues? Do you sometimes find yourself in front of audiences who are
nonplussed? Mostly.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah.
I mean, our triumph was down in Market Festival.
Last year, just about a year
where
ago.
Where we were kind of competing with the tannoy system that was telling people where to park their cars every few minutes, and just kind of totally cutting over the music.
Yeah.
And in the end, they decided to close us down. I think it's when we first started playing No Incinerator.
We played Ruling Class, Riot for Austerity, and No Incinerator after the mayor's speech. Then the councillors who were running this other arena had a vote, close the music stage down, and the really nice biker vicar who Kate was the messenger. And we said, well, it's too late, we finished our set.
So it was a nice bit of back and forth over loud, seeing whose system was louder.
Yes, yeah.
So unfortunately, our triumph was alienating the, the so-called power brokers of Downham Market Town Council. And the same thing happened at Swaffham Free Festival, where when we performed Ruling Class, Gillian Shepherd, do you remember, Minister of Education, Tory drone, one of our locals, she stormed off during the set, apparently, you know, and so...
Well, I think you should be definitely seeking opportunities to do that. Because this is the thing about, one of the things I really like about music is they actually got their ass together to vote to shut the music stage, which means they'd already heard the message.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
They can't unhear it. Their response. Yeah. And cool, it's in their heads now, bless them.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, it's just... And then you go, well, where else are we going to play? Because that's the trouble with our local festivals. They're so... You don't get this around here in Norfolk.
It's like, actually, people... What I'm finding is people seem not to want to hear stuff that is a bit challenging, a bit kind of provoking, a bit sort of... A bit uncomfortable about, you know, the way that we all live our lives, actually. And I'm struck even here, you know, that what I perceive is that people want a good time. They want to feel good. They want to not be troubled by stuff. They want to kind of feel something that's quite light and bubbly.
Yeah.
And so Dark Patrick, which to my mind was one of the most interesting things I heard, there's hardly anybody in there. You know,
I think that is something that's changing because I go to places like... getting noisy. I go to places like the Green Gathering and the Truth Juice Gathering and the Critical Mass Radio, and there you get entirely awake audiences, people who are to one extent or another actually kind of on the mark.
But we applied to a lot. I applied to quite a lot of festivals this year, and it was terribly discouraging, all that internet application form stuff. And like, we went, oh, we're on the near the top of the waiting list to play at the Big Green Gathering.
Just the Green Gathering now.
Yeah, the reserve list. Yeah. So,
they should take you off the reserve list and put you on the... I see.
Put a word in for us.
I work for a couple of crews that work at the Green Gathering, and we'll see if we can get a message through, because I think they know the people. Obviously, the people who know me know the people who run it.
I tell you what it is. Our guitarist is the youngest member of the band. He's sort of around 40-ish.
Yeah.
We're in our 50s, Les is a bit older, and none of us are really very, you know, kind of internet, social media kind of familiar. So John, bless him, does his best with Facebook and everything, but we're not very good at knowing quite how to do all this stuff, really.
No, I agree.
We're still with the old, you know, LPs.
Yes. Well done. I mean, you know, if it wasn't for the radio show, I really wouldn't be doing any of that at all. And I don't do Facebook or any of that stuff. But find emails and, you know, it's useful to be able to chat. But blimey, it doesn't have to take some time.
It does.
Yes.
It does.
So, but, you know, if you want to make a band work, it seems like you've got to put in the hours. And so you get a bit more dispersed when you're older. You've got things like grown-up kids that sort of need help.
Yeah, suddenly pop up.
And bits of your body that sort of don't cooperate so readily. But, you know, we actually... Why shouldn't we be doing this mischief, you know? I think it's good fun.
Yeah, well, 10 out of 10 to you, that's what I say. Thanks very much for being there and doing the job. And I should look forward to seeing you elsewhere. I think.
Good.
You know.
Thank you. And really touched by your encouragement. Thank you.
Yeah, it was.
I really didn't. It's especially surprising here because it is all such upbeat music and it is.
It was actually Diney.
Yes.
It was Diney who. We're friends of Diney. And actually, Diney did a permaculture course that we kind of organised.
Yeah.
And
So you do.
So she listened to us. And we built a straw bale timber house and all that. We kind of have it.
Carol started the West Norfolk permaculture course. She basically did all the work to get.
Not all, no.
Well, get that course up and
we
running.
With friends locally.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Transition.
That's absolutely great. Yeah. So, what sort of area are you talking about?
Well, just
West Norfolk.
Actually, people from London have come, and you know, it's quite a well-known course now, actually.
Brilliant. Because I really like the permaculture thing. I think it's one of those things when I look around and I see, well, that is a definite sign of progress.
Yeah.
If we could, by some means, start getting hold of land, that's the way I'd like to see people use it. And I do now, occasionally. We saw some people at a place called...
There's no such thing as proper tea. That's the problem, isn't it?
Yes, no such thing as proper tea. There's only unity and sovereignty.
Well, it's certainly good to be sort of connected to people who are increasingly thinking about ways of sharing land, of cooperatively, whatever, and different ways of making what people are fortunate enough to have available for the wider community.
This is actually
that for me is one of the main things about this festival. I haven't met, is it Marion? I haven't met her, but I've seen her around, and I kind of feel like what she's done is quite amazing, actually.
Yes, it is. Yeah. It is. It's a very strong team they've got here, and they do a lot of work for us. But it is. Yeah. It's another reason why I like this festival, is because I came first for the second year, is to have seen that develop and see the team, see what happens to them as they go from being a small festival to being what's basically a sellout this year.
Yeah.
1,500 people. It can't really get any bigger than this and stay here.
No.
And it needs to stay here in order to be what it is. So,
not go down the growth route.
I'm hoping it'll just become a deeply exclusive gig.
Zero growth for Fire in the Mountain.
That's it. You just continue to pull
austerity measures.
To pull, you know, better and better quality, or you know, more compact quality of band and punter.
Yeah.
You know, I think.
Yeah, I would be very sad if it became a kind of Glastonbury sort of experience.
Yes. Well, it'd be interesting to see how it develops, but so I guess you'll be coming back then, perhaps.
Well, if we're invited back.
You wouldn't come back just for the experience and the beer.
We'll see.
Well, we don't drink much beer, so...
Maybe.
Well, I guess what... If we're going to expend our energy camping in summers, we want to be doing gigs as part of our expending energy. So it's whoever invites us. It seems to be that our music, where does what the music we're making find a home? And my intuition has been, well, festival audiences will get it more than pub audiences. Although I'm quite happy to try the odd pub and get people going, you what, mate?
Yeah.
Or then your standard rock venues that will only book you if you come from the other side of the world, or they've heard of you, and of course we haven't got that traction yet. So
But
it's sort of, you come to festival and you meet loads of other people who go, oh yeah, come and do this and that, like you.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's really important that we talk with each other, and you know, that way our influence and what have you is passing from hand to hand. Because I remember reading that when I first started out in business years ago, before I abandoned it entirely, I read a book called Marketing Without Advertising.
Okay.
And it said basically, the first three chapters basically were all about how advertising was futile, and it said what you want is word of mouth and repeat trade. And I was a landscaper, I thought, well, that's got to be bollocks for landscaping, but it turned out to be absolutely true.
Yeah.
It's especially true for entertainers and, you know, and people on the festival circuit and all of that, because it does expand.
Yes, it's because we've played in Cayley bands for years, and fixed Cayley bands, and when I was really active doing that, it was all like somebody recommended and all that, and you just kept doing
never
it.
Never advertised,
never got it together.
No, well, now we know it's just a waste of money. So I wish you both the best with the band. I really look forward to playing some of the music, and indeed seeing you again. I'll have a word with Diane and make sure she tries to keep you on the list for this one.
Oh, bless you.
So
at least you get the food ticket.
Yeah. Well, actually, very pleased.
We got paid.
We didn't know we were getting paid, and that was really nice. So
excellent. That's another thing, because that is not... The people might think that's de rigueur to pay the bands, but there's whole festivals now where the bands come... expenses, if they're lucky. You know, the
pay-to-play experience.
Yes, indeed.
So thank you to Joe for taking Diney's word and booking us. I haven't spoken to him this weekend, but that was great. And thank you, Dr. Rock.
Yes.
Thank you very much, John Preston.
Thank you.
And thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
That was brilliant. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, the world's first DIY tribute band.
Yes.
And remember, compliance is death.
Yes, Donald Winnicott.
Yeah. Thanks, folks.
Thank you. Pretty brilliant.
Thank you. Yeah, great.
That's great. We better get back to our...
Yeah, we'll be. Yeah, and I shall
thank
now
you.
Go...
I'll now a very go. Nice interlude.
Brilliant, glad you enjoyed it.
I want what I want and I want it now, and I'm not going to stop till I get what I want, and I'll do everything to make it that way. And I've forgotten the art of play, but I don't give a damn unless it pays. I've lost all trust, gotta make my own way, and I'll grab and grasp and hold on tight with all my strength and all my might. I present to you my wish list, fulfill all this, I insist. My cravings, they will never desist, so my strivings, they will always persist. So give me everything I want. I want everything that you have got, so give me everything I want. I want everything that you have got. I'm sorry I can't meet your insatiable demand. We can't seem to share a rational plan. I fear you want me to spend, spend, spend. I dread it all meeting a bitter end as I toil to fill an unfillable gap with guilt and weakness and assorted crap as I struggle to articulate the word no. I fear losing your love, and then you go to a place I cannot influence, where we can find no confluence. Another wrench in our hearts. Sentiments, they pull us apart. I give you everything I've got. It's not always what you think you want, and I give you everything I've got. It's not always what you think you want. Come on. Me. We feed each other in the darkest of ways and fool ourselves we're happy this way, but wants are always gonna get got unless we wake up, they're not gonna stop. We kill and steal in the smallest of ways and turn our backs upon the pain, but it finds its way back into our heart where we wish to look but fear to start. Running this way we'll find no end, the way out of misery you cannot spend, so stay a while with your stack. Let's listen for some feedback. Are you happy with what you've got? Are you happy with what you think you want? Are you happy with what you've got? Are you happy with what you think you want? How many things I have?
That was the John Preston tribute band playing Give Me Everything I Want, also off Ruling Class. They describe themselves as the world's first DIY tribute band, presenting protest jingles, rants and anthems, recycled minimalist riffs, grooves and snatches of half-familiar chants about shopping, collapse, liberation and the insubstantiality of self, which is pretty much what they did, actually. When I saw them, they didn't have the guitarist with them, as they said, because he was away working with Dr. Feelgood, because there was a bit more money in that. So we saw the lounge version of the band, and... Sorry about that. Dropped the stream there for a minute. Don't know quite what happened, but we seem to have got it back. Yeah, I was saying that we saw the lounge version of the John Preston tribute band because they didn't have the guitarist with them, and that left a pretty huge hole in their sound, as I'm sure you can imagine. But they were still pretty impressive, and we will be hearing over the weeks a few more of their tunes, like FUKT in the UK, and Full Catastrophe, Riot for Austerity, and Pharma Talk. They've done some pretty good tunes. I enjoyed talking with them, and it was also pretty good to see them at Fire in the Mountain. It gave us there's quite a broad variety of music available. The stuff I'm playing tonight really is just a skim across the top. Many of the bands that I saw that I would really have liked to have played don't actually have any CDs. I've commented on this before about the Fire in the Mountain. Lots and lots of the people that are playing there, they only really seem to play live, which I guess is a grand thing in itself. One of the reasons why I'm finding festivals so fascinating nowadays is it is an opportunity to kind of see how community works. When challenges arise on the ground, they need to be dealt with instantly, and some of the challenges can be pretty surprising, pretty major, and whoever it is that finds themselves faced with them has to deal with them. This is not, in my experience, the way it necessarily works out in the real world, where when the shit hits the fan, somebody phones the authorities or gets somebody else to come to deal with it. You really don't have that option. So you've got maybe 15, 16, 1700 people, I don't know how many people were there in the field. You've got to get rid of all their own waste, all their rubbish. They've got to be fed, moved around. Vehicles have got to be got in and out. People have got to be moved backwards and forwards and all that kind of stuff. It really is it's a substantial challenge. Nonetheless, the Fire in the Mountain is really the closest thing that me and Synchro get to a holiday in the year. We do quite a lot of stuff whilst we're there, but it's somehow there's something about the place which is chill and relaxing even when you're being kept well busy. And one of the major problems is actually dealing with the rubbish. We've seen just really huge challenges arise in other festivals for that. In fact, you know, sometimes it really does bring them down. And after the next bunch of tunes, I'm going to be talking a little bit to Jed, who's the man who's been recycling the rubbish from the Fire in the Mountain for the last 3 or 4 years. I think he's done all 4 years. I've always been a little bit intrigued by seeing teams of people picking their way through piles of plastic and tin and glass and all the rest of it, sorting it carefully into bags, because having spoken to people like Mark Windows and one or two other people who live in major conurbations, it appears to me that a lot of the rubbish that we think we're recycling is in fact just going to landfill. I was even told recently that the recycling targets are actually met by people who are entrained to put things into little coloured bins, and once that's been done, you can tick the relevant box and put it in the landfill anyway. So I was quite interested to get a chance to talk to Jed, but before that, we're going to have another quick bundle of tunes from the festival, a fairly good variety of stuff here. And in case any of you were wondering what a mixture of modern keyboards and a hurdy-gurdy sounds like, I've got a little bit of Dark Patrick here. It's a track called Rise of the Underworld. Being as they were recommended by John, I thought we'd perhaps listen to one of them. So here's Rise of the Underworld from Dark Patrick.
with your clever reply. You're not fooling anybody.
Bristol Afrobeat project with a tune, How You Get a Life. One of the things the Doctor really likes is a big horn section, and my impression of that band was that it was almost entirely horn section. I didn't see the whole of the set, unfortunately, but we'll be seeking out some CDs of theirs. I lifted that particular one off YouTube. Very, very exciting band, and it's not often you'll be getting to hear funky music played on Dr. Rock, but Fire in the Mountain gives me a bit of an excuse. Before Bristol Afrobeat, another band that were, I thought, really astonishing. They've got lots of great tunes. They got on the list tonight on the Stroppy Lyric tag. So we like a good fiddle, we like a big horn section, and we like a stroppy lyric. That song was called They Chose to Lead Us off their Karma EP, and we'll be hearing more of them over the next few weeks as well. And before that, the incredibly weird Dark Patrick, who I shall also be investigating a little more. One of the main challenges, it seems to me, of festivals is the business of rubbish. It does seem to me that when festivals start, they're quite small, as indeed Fire of the Mountain was, and the recent Tribal Love Cooperative's Unity Dance. And when you've only got a small bunch of people who are, if you like, committed to coming to the early festival because they know people that are there, and they know that the bands are going to be on, or things like that, you seem to get a different level of responsibility, if you like. And the level of responsibility is kind of indicated primarily, I think, by the amount of rubbish that actually gets dropped. Because obviously the more sensitive amongst us realise that if we don't drop the rubbish, then other people don't have to pick it up. It seems pretty clear and plain to me. As it is, all festivals, to a certain extent, need a rubbish recycling team, and it's quite a substantial team of people. They're always, in my experience, really chill chaps and really well worth talking with and hanging out with and the like. Now, and it's I think last year Jed, who was running the Aberystwyth Recycling Centre, who we're going to hear from next, managed to recycle something like 70% of the rubbish that came from the festival, which is by all accounts pretty impressive. I think we managed to recycle a little less this year. And it turns out to be an incredibly complicated business. I've done many volunteering tasks at festivals, but actually sorting through the rubbish is somewhere where I draw a line, a bit like working on the wrong side of the bar. I only really work on the punter's side of the bar. I did have an encounter with rubbish at the Tribal Love Cooperative gig, because as volunteer coordinator, it was my job to coordinate such volunteers as I had, and one of the things we had to do was deal with all the garbage that was being turned out. Not a lot of stuff was recycled from that one because we didn't have a whole team of people to do it. Another of my main memories of rubbish at festivals was the old Out of the Ordinary Festival, which was a classic example of how a festival began small. It was the primary Earth Energies Festival in the UK. It was a really, really beautiful gig, and they worked very hard at composting things, recycling things. We had ceremonies to start the festival and end it, a peace circle in the middle, and a lot of attention was kept to maintaining all of that stuff. But the last year that I went to the Out of the Ordinary, which may well have been actually the last year that it was the Out of the Ordinary, in fact, it had got really quite big. It had got to the point, as they do after 3 or 4 years, you start attracting hedonists. The name of the festival itself, because it's a really beautiful place to be and it has a kind of function and a name which it sticks to, it gets itself a name, and eventually you start attracting a lot of people carrying in kind of piles of beer cans and all the rest of it. And what seems to happen is that the amount of rubbish that just gets dropped on the ground increases. Also, there tends to be a bit of increasing challenge for security, a bit of an increasing challenge for a team that's used to working with cooperative, compassionate and sensitive people. And it makes it all a lot more difficult to deal with. And I think what happened at the Out of the Ordinary was that at the very beginning of the festival, I think maybe even on the first day, there was a bit of disagreement between the management and the recycling team, with the result that the recycling team left. And once the, there was a few thousand people at the Out of the Ordinary, I think, but once the 8 or 10 people who are dealing with the rubbish goes, then there is absolutely nobody to deal with the rubbish. This is one of the things that I like about festivals, is that they give you a bit of a kind of a microcosmic view of how society is working. So what was happening there was a few people were willing to stand up and take responsibility for the rubbish. Once those people go, there is nobody to take responsibility. And the result was, at the end of the festival, when we were trying to clear up piles and piles and piles of black plastic bin liners full of completely unsorted rubbish. Now, whilst I don't have much, or at least I've got a lot more understanding of it, having spoken to Jed, it's only a little interview, 15 minutes or so, I was pretty distressed by the way that particular festival looked when it finished. It also had trouble with the other end of the rubbish, which is just how many toilets they had on site and all that, which was which I really don't want to go into right now. Fire in the Mountains seemed to have that pretty much on a balance. We had 8 or 10 earth closets. You can call them composting loos, but basically it's a matter of crapping in the ground and then covering it up. So it's not... I like to think of composting toilets as ones where you can actually... reclaim the stuff that comes out the back and use it for growing fruit trees and stuff. Nonetheless, there was plenty of those, tens quite a lot, and they were very comfortable, really beautifully built. Had a bit of trouble in that the doors wouldn't lock, and there seemed to be a whole bunch of people who don't want to deal with composting toilets, and so it's necessary to have a few porta cabins as well. They were filling up pretty regularly, but were also regularly emptied. This is not always the case either. So that one, pretty much on the balance, I reckon they got that just about right, although they were cutting it a bit fine. Also, there's still a little bit of work to be done on the straw bale urinals, although I think the principle's sound. What we probably need is bigger holes full of rocks underneath them. But the rubbish at Fire in the Mountain, we were pretty close, I think, to not being able to have a recycling team there, and as we're going to hear in Jed's interview, that's because of insurance companies, somewhat bizarrely. But what it meant was that Jed's company went down just a little bit before the festival, which meant that, strictly speaking, I guess he had absolutely no need to be there. But it has to be said that the groundwork for what was a pretty successful recycling operation, the place was looking very tidy and everything had been sorted into its various sacks by the end of it. And the foundations for that success were another basic principle of helping out at festivals, which is that those people that arrive there early do have to do quite a lot of work. I mean, once all of your volunteers turn up and you've got, I don't know, all of your stewards and everything other than the site team is there, then it kind of swings along whilst the festival's there. But these people tend to turn up just before the festival starts, and they tend to go immediately after it's finished. So there is a lot of hard work that needs to be done by those brave souls who turn up early. There are obviously payoffs in that it's really great working with the core team. I discovered that myself personally, really, for the first time at the TLC gig at Beltane in May, when, as the volunteer coordinator, if volunteers were needed to do things early in the festival before the volunteers had turned up, then there's really not enough people to do it. So I ended up doing quite a lot of veg prep, washing up, little bit of rubbish clearance, quite a lot of time on the gate. It was useful experience for me, because it meant that when my volunteers did turn up, I actually knew what it was that I was going to be asking them to do. And the Thursday, and to a certain extent the Friday, were very, very hard work indeed. Nonetheless, I really want to tip my hat to Kath, who was the one lady that was there from the recycling team from, well, as soon as we arrived. We got there on the Tuesday. I think they started letting people in on the Thursday, and the gig kicked off on the Friday. And nobody knew what was going to happen because Jed's company had been undermined, somewhat filthily, I think. It was not clear that what was going to happen to the rubbish, but Kath, as a complete little dynamo, actually went round and set up recycling stations in all the major parts of the site, made sure that there were bins and bags and all of that stuff carefully labelled. And it does have to be said that where there were these places, then still the people that attended the festival were actually pretty good at bunging their stuff in the relevant bins. Although it is my impression that as well as there being a lot more people carrying shed loads of beer into the festival and so not putting really any of their money or effort into the festival, but rather into getting stuff cheap elsewhere, which is fair enough payment. I used to do that. That was in the days when I used to leave festivals with places like Reading literally had a carpet of beer cans and plastic and Christ knows what else, right the way over a whole 30 or 40,000 individual arena at the end of a day, and a load of garbage trucks came in and kind of collected all of that up, swept the place clean so that we could do it all again the next day. Really, having left so much shit lying around the place over my first 10 or 15 years in festivals, I do regard it as a bit of a duty nowadays. When I'm up, I tend to be early shift at festivals, to do a bit of litter clearing about the place. And it was definitely my impression this year that a considerable amount more rubbish was being dropped on the floor. Nonetheless, I think Jed's job would have been a lot harder if it hadn't been for one individual, that wee Kath, doing all of the groundwork that she did. Really quite astonishing. And she was also up first thing every morning, tidying the place up, dragging bins around the place, and all of that. So it's... whilst it's not a particularly attractive subject, it is something that really brings to mind how much stuff we must be throwing away in the real world, seeing what's being chucked away at festivals. One of the major challenges at festivals nowadays is that people don't like glass to be brought in. And there was indeed supposed to be a no-glass rule at Fire in the Mountain, which meant that, strictly speaking, I guess the security, and we'll be talking to a security man again later in the show, would have been responsible for taking glass off people as they came through the door. Now, at the moment, that is not a challenge that we have. It is something that I find personally pretty difficult, because I don't like drinking out of plastic and I don't like drinking out of tin. Although, if it's the only beer left, I'll drink it out of more or less anything. And I think also it makes a substantial difference to a festival if you've got to have somebody on the gate making sure that the inside of the festival is different from the outside. And if you're going to be taking glass off people, then that's going to be the case. And it does end up also getting taken to extremes, because that was one of the really serious problems with the Secret Garden Party that I had, was that they weren't only taking people's alcohol off them, they were taking water off them if it was in glass. They were even taking Bach flower remedies off people that come in these tiny little glass bottles because it was in glass. So you are really, when you start deciding to do that, stepping the other side of a very difficult line as far as I'm concerned. So there was a lot of glass, a lot of bottles there. Not as far as I'm aware did none of it actually got broken. But again, all of this stuff has to be dealt with. So I decided to have a word with Jed, having seen so many recycling teams beavering away over the years and not really knowing very much about it and suspecting the whole thing was something of a con. I thought I'd round Jed up after the festival, after he'd finished tidying up all of the stuff that had got delivered to the collection point, and see what he had to say. We'd had a fairly extensive chat about plastic, which is one of the most difficult things that they have to deal with. There's apparently 7 different sorts of it and they can't be mixed up and all that kind of stuff. And chatting with Kath, she tells me that plastic is effectively one of the most indestructible things that mankind has created. And she told me, I don't know whether it's correct or not, but I don't see any reason to disbelieve her, that some of the beaches we've got are now up to sort of 25-30% broken down plastic. And this is because people are releasing items that are said to be biodegradable. which they're not. They're kind of degradable. What they do is they break down into ever smaller parts of themselves, so you always end up with a little bit of plastic and then a smaller bit of plastic and a smaller bit of plastic until, I guess, we might end up with kind of like video game beaches that are kind of all made out of plastic rather than sand. They look like one thing and they are something else. So plastic doesn't really biodegrade. As a result, in the early part of the interview, we talk a fair bit about plastic, but we get on to just exactly what it was that happened to Jed's company, which I think is most unfortunate given all of the work that he'd put in to get it going. Still, here we go. Here's a quick 15-minute chat about rubbish recycling from the Fire in the Mountain Fest with Jed of the Aberystwyth Recycling Centre. So I've got Jed with me, who's been running the recycling end of things, and with a bunch of willing volunteers. Thanks for coming and talking to us, Jed.
No problem.
The subject of recycling really interests me because I've now seen a lot of people sorting at various festivals, sorting really carefully through all the different plastics and that. But at the same time, I'm told by friends of mine in London that they've actually followed some of the recycling trucks down there and they just get chucked into the landfill. Is there a difference in the way this is treated in different places?
Yes, there is. The thing is about plastic is the first process that happens to it when it gets to the factory to be recycled is it's melted, okay? Well, nowadays more places wash it first and then shred it, but it's the big companies that can afford this. Those have got the robotic sorting and everything.
Yeah.
But if it's contaminated with paper or like margarine tubs, lots of people just scrape the margarine out and recycle them, and they can't make it to the end. It's got to be clean. So it has to be clean with plastic.
So if it is clean and it's sorted properly, it's a commercially viable entity at that point.
Yes, but even then, there's particular plastics, PET, standard pop bottle.
Yeah.
They are, everything is in place for those to be recycled.
Yeah.
In the old days, you had to take the cap off first.
Yeah, I remember that.
We had a machine at work that used to pierce the bottles. So all the bottles had to go through a piercing machine first.
Yeah.
And then you could bale them.
Yeah.
But you started on plastics. Plastics are the most complicated issue for recycling.
I'm kind of more interested in in the fact that, obviously, you've mentioned quite a lot of machinery and sorting it into different sorts. Yeah. Obviously, what I'm after establishing is that in some parts of the country, people are collecting this stuff, sorting it and selling it on. Is that?
Yes, indeed, yeah.
Not just dragging it down to landfill after.
Yeah, but then again, all our stuff is done hand-sorted.
Yeah.
And if we find something that's really, like a red sauce bottle.
Yeah.
Well, firstly, a red sauce bottle is number 7, which is a resin. It's not, it can't readily be recycled.
Right, okay.
So all black sauce bottles, brown sauce bottles, normally don't get recycled.
Yeah.
But people still put them in.
Yeah.
And very often you find them with a load of red sauce at the bottom.
Yeah.
That again puts things off. Plus it has to be clean.
Yeah.
And paper. In the old days with the carrier bags, carrier bags were starting to be recycled, before we had the biodegradable ones, which isn't a good thing for recycling. Biodegradable is not. Is not a good idea, in my opinion. But the carrier bags, people used to leave their tilver seat in the bottom of the carrier bag and then recycle the bag.
Yeah.
Well, that is a big problem because paper and plastic really, really don't mix.
Yeah.
When it's melted down, the paper blocks up all the little jets and it's a big
problem. Were you in you, because you've been running your own recycling business, which we'll talk a little bit about what happened to that shortly, but so you basically collected, sorted and baled up tin cans, all the different sorts of plastic, and then who did you sell them to? And what sort of value, say, is a bale of aluminium cans?
Okay, it goes up and down, it really does. They're at the moment, I think, about £600-650 a tonne, if they're baled.
Right.
The moisture content is very important. They deduct moisture, so if you've got cans that have got lots of juice in when you bale them, it holds the moisture.
Yeah.
If they find anything magnetic in there, that decreases the value. But they do an aluminium drinks can in 6 weeks can be back on the shelf again. Right. If it's all done right. So yeah. that is
good. And £650 a bale, mind you, a ton.
No,
bale,
that's a ton. 56,000 cans make one ton.
Right.
56,000, that's a lot.
Yeah. So did you have machinery for drying out the cans, say?
No, we had machinery for sorting the cans. Yeah. Basically a magnet, really, on a machine, and the cans drop a conveyor belt over the magnet.
Yeah.
If they're steel, they stick and go under and back into another bin.
Yeah.
And if they're aluminium, they just go forward. Then we bail them up then.
So, I mean, presumably this enterprise grew around you over, was it 25 years?
25 years. Yeah. We started off, if I start at the beginning, we started off as a Friends of the Earth group, the Aberystwyth Friends of the Earth group, and my job and my colleague who started the business with me was to put pressure on the council to consider recycling. And this was in the old days. We're back in 1988-89 now, when recycling wasn't the word for everything. I mean, everything now, everybody's a recycler now. It seems that all the businesses that used to be scrap men are recyclers.
Are they genuinely recycling, most of these people?
I think, certainly scrap men. That's how they make the money, you know. It's no point collecting stuff and not being able to get rid of it, which is one of the weak things to recycling. You know, you get all this stuff. Here at the Skip, people are bringing stuff and they expect it to be recycled, but at this site, I'm limited to what I can take.
Yeah.
In fact, now that I don't have my business, I'm limited to what I can take because I have to prepare it for the way the next guy is going to take it and what he wants, his requirements. Not, you know, I know what can be done, but I've got to do it how he wants it. I'm worried about the bags, those big bags that I've got it in, that he might say to me, oh, how am I going to deal with those? Quick, I've got to rebag it all or something. I'm hoping he's not going to say that, but he might do.
Yeah.
So I don't know. This is the first time I've done it when I haven't had all the infrastructure, all the machinery, all the things that I have at work. You know.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to the start. So we were speaking to the council, and they said, "Well, if recycling, let Birmingham do it first." And the plan was, this guy was quite serious about this, that if Birmingham recycles everything, and then Telford might think, "Oh, look, Birmingham is recycling everything, so we in Telford could take all our waste to Birmingham and it would be recycled." Okay? And then Shrewsbury might think, "Oh, look, Telford are recycling, we'll collect all our..." And eventually, 20 years later, someone in Aberystwyth might say, "Oh, look..." But so we went away at that. The council wouldn't deal with Friends of the Earth. Who are Friends of the Earth? That's what they said. Mm-hmm. Today you want to recycle everything, tomorrow you want to ban the bomb, the next day you want to save the whale. Friends of the Earth, who is Mr. Friends of the Earth? Who is the man we speak to? As a council, we have to deal with an individual.
Yeah.
And we need a face. And so that's at that point, me and my partner said, okay, well, we are the face of recycling in Aberystwyth. We are called the Aberystwyth Recycling Centre. And it went from there.
Yeah.
And eventually, eight years later, they started giving us some sort of support, and it went from there. But then Europe did all its thing, and every council must do this, and the landfill tax all came in, so they were obliged to it. Now they have we have a curbside bag that everybody puts what they think is recycling in it.
Yeah.
Now, it isn't necessarily what is recycling, but what they think. And one in four of those bags is landfill, no doubt about it.
Mm.
People who put all their cans and their plastic bottles and things in a bag, then they shred their paper, because lots of people now are shredding their documents, and then they pour that on top. That bag is to the tip straight away, because plastic and paper don't mix. So if you start getting shredded paper inside a plastic bottle, they won't...
My impression is that there is no education on that.
No education at all, no. You just do what you think.
It actually is quite a complicated thing to be giving to your householder, who normally probably couldn't give much of a toss anyway.
Yeah.
I find it very comforting to find that some of this stuff is getting recycled, because in the urban and metropolitan areas, it seems to me that the government is apparently, anyway, achieving its targets simply by having civilians put stuff into plastic buckets, and then after that, it can go and landfill it. And everybody's making plenty of money on the way. How widespread is our actual proper recycling plants that are selling on stuff that for future use?
Well, it's it's the big companies now that do it in bulk. Okay, there's small players like myself. I mean, really, that you either get brought out by a big company.
Yeah.
Which didn't happen to us. It could have done if we had our own premises, but we were renting the premises. When you have like robotic sorting now, so all you do is you just load the hopper with all the recycling, and it goes on the conveyor, and robotic arms just come up and
even the plastics.
Yeah, plastics. They can even identify the different plastics.
Really?
They, you know, and that's so fast, it's staggering. They cost about £1 million each arm, but the big companies. It's the big companies. I'm a victim of the big companies, really. Yeah. Like so, insurance companies, in my case.
Yeah. What happened to this this business so carefully built over 25 years?
What happened? We in 2012 we paid £2,000 a year for our buildings insurance. Under our lease, we had to have insurance, buildings insurance. It was a thing in the lease, so there's no way getting around it. It was £2,000. Then it went to £5,000, which is a big jump, but there we are. And then this year, £39,000 they wanted. £39,000.
From £2,000 to £39,000 in 3 years.
Yeah. And under the lease, we had to. We had to either find the money or go. And
really, how did the insurance company? Did they make any attempt to justify that?
We tried to get somebody to come and talk to us to see how we could, you know, sort of lower our risk, but they weren't interested. And there's only one company in the UK, I'm told, that deals with underwriting of recycling centres.
That was going to be my very next question.
And you do hear about these big players, the big companies again, you know, like something drops out of the sky, one of those... those candle things that float up. And that set fire to somewhere in Birmingham
I remember hearing about that.
And that was, you know, hundreds of tons of stuff.
They're a bit unlucky to have it catch fire that easy, you would have thought.
Yeah. Well, it does happen a lot. And it makes you wonder, is that because they can't sell it or because it's I mean, it has to be right. A bale of cardboard has to be a bale of cardboard. But very often you see a bale of cardboard and it's got string and straws and plastic and just crap in the middle. Yeah. And, you know, everything we did was always hand-sorted and everything was pulled out. It was a clean, clean bale.
With facing 35,000 on insurance, you just had to stop.
Yeah.
And that happened just at the end of last week.
Well, we knew at the end of March. And it was quite fortunate because we invoice our customers quarterly. The businesses that we collect from, the hospitals, the universities, we invoice them on a quarterly basis. And fortunately, it was just like 2 weeks before our invoice was due.
Yeah.
Had I have invoiced everybody and been paid to deliver a service that I then could, that would have been another nightmare.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was shocking. We put a letter on our website, and we sent letters out to all our customers and said that we just can't do it anymore.
And yet here you are with a team of people doing the rubbish as committed firing the mountain.
Yeah, there we are.
Well, it seems like an heroic deed.
Yeah, well, it's the whole retirement thing as well. There's people who just can't wait to retire, and there's other people who are quite horrified about what am I going to do with myself.
Yeah.
And I think I fit in the latter category.
So what's you going?
What am I going to do with myself?
So what are you going to do?
I don't know. I'm still wondering. But I'll get this festival out of the way, and then we'll see. But I won't be going to work tomorrow, which will be strange.
Yeah,
you know. Yeah. Even though I'm well aware of it, and I know, and the factory's all closed, and that was very sad, because I remember like when a machine arrived, we'd saved up, we'd struggled to get this machine, and we've got it now, and we paid £20,000 for it or whatever.
Yeah.
And we had it, and it was great. All these machines went for a few hundred pounds, not thousands.
It's nothing less than a fraud, isn't it, really, that's been perpetrated on you?
It is most unjust, We did, we do have a very good MP here, and I was hoping to talk to him to see if he could do anything, but of course he was off in some other country, and we only had really 2 weeks to decide, do we find £39,000 or do we stop? And But again, with the curbside bag, when I started, people wanted to recycle. People would come and say, oh, well, how do I do it? What do you want me to bring you? And it got around that way. Now, everybody's got the curbside bag. It all goes in the curbside bag. I don't see much of that. We used to have it from the council. We had 9,300 bags a week we used to deal with. All hand-sorted.
Wow. How many people did you have doing that?
At the most, we had 14 people.
Right.
But seven, it was seven at the end. Went at the end. You know. I forgot what I was saying now.
Sorry, yeah.
But
you know, you used to get it from the council, the curbside recycling.
That's right, yeah.
And that just basically was reducing the amount of stuff that was coming through, was it?
Oh, yeah. Well, when we do, because they now send it off to a company in South Wales. So it's not local anymore. You know, and this is it. All the things.
And that's
that
aren't
you local,
said you're doing 9,600 bags a week.
9,300, yeah.
Now they're driving them to Swansea or somewhere.
Yeah. But the plan is it will go to Holland.
Oh, from there.
The councils, a few councils in South Wales have all got together.
Yes.
And they've all done a package deal. Yeah. With somebody in Holland. I don't really know the details, but...
And they'll have a huge plant wherever it is.
And off it goes.
We're full of robots.
Probably, yeah.
Tip it in one end, spits it out as money at the other.
That's the sort of thing.
Wicked. Well, thanks very much for having a chat with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And for doing the recycling, of course.
It's a thing I've done, what I do. Yeah. I am a recycler. What will happen this time next year, I don't know, but I dare say they'll ask me to do it again, and I've proved over the years, really, against all the odds, even in the rain, that we can deliver.
You certainly have.
We'll see.
Well, thanks a lot, Jeff.
Okay.
That was brilliant, Tar. And best of luck in whatever happens next.
Yeah.
I bet it's just made way for something even better.
There we are. Yeah. Okay.
I was down at work a few days ago and another load of that needs sorting. No one else has got it done because recycling is important. These two geezers come out of the shed and I know what they're thinking. It's just a load of cans and bottles and paper. Anyways, I'll bag it up and take it now. He says,
"Here, what store are you from? What store are you from? You got any ID?
Got any ID? We'll only have that polythene. Won't touch PVC. We'll only take polythene."
I said, "Where's this bit of cardboard go? And what about the glass? Will you take this Nacatelli?
No, you can kiss my arse.
And this box of junk that I packed up was sifted through and through. And these pair of awkward buggers just looked and puffed and blew.
Recyclables may look alike, but they ain't all the same. You can't mix plastic bottle tops with polyurethane. Those bits of wood ain't treated. They go in that one there.
And what about this horse meat?
We'll have it. We don't care.
Let's go to Labby."
I took my sofa to the yard, but it was just too late. The council changed the opening hours. Now they close at 8.
Yeah, what are you doing about with that old thing? You know DFS are coming tomorrow.
No, I know, love, but the bloody recycling yard was shut, innit?
I don't care, just sort it.
What store are you from? What store are you from? You got any ID?
Got any ID? We'll only have that polythene. Won't touch PVC.
We read your leaflet.
That was Jakey Z doing his tune Ted's Recycling Yard, which I just couldn't resist having just spoken with Jed about his recycling yard. Jakey Z wasn't performing at the festival or there, but like I say, it was a good opportunity to play his tune, and I'm sure that Jakey would have really, really enjoyed Fire in the Mountain. Jed is a really, really committed, thoughtful, lovely bloke, I thought. He worked really, really hard, and he'd spent 25 years working his way into being a specialist in his field. And I mean, 56,000 aluminium cans to make up one ton for £650. That's astonishing, isn't it? And they've all got to be kind of dried out and squashed and baled nicely and all of that. And Jed told me loads of stuff about our plastic beer glasses that have got a bit of straw on them or a bit of mud on them and no good. He's just like a mine of information, and I personally will be a lot more fussy about my recycling, possibly at home as far as I can and as far as I've got one, but certainly at festivals. I thought it was pretty interesting that the council didn't want to deal with Friends of the Earth, because I guess it's a kind of amorphous named organisation and nobody's kind of liable or pinnable down for anything, but they insisted that they must have individuals to deal with, presumably so when the time comes they can screw their asses to the floor or something, which is basically what they've done to Jed. I mean, for your insurance to go from £2,000 to £3,000 to £39,000 over 3 years, I would really seriously like to know where the actuarial risk lies that actually resulted in that particular move. I was talking with Vin earlier actually, and he said that you know, he can he's got some ideas as to what could be done about that, and there's a conversation that I'd really like to follow up, because of course Jed was the victim of a monopoly. Effectively, there's only one underwriter who in the nation who will insure operations like Jed's, and that means you can just ask what you like, because if you don't hand it over, we're just going to shut you down. And they gave him 2 weeks' notice. That's what he said. He knew a couple of weeks beforehand. So, yeah, there didn't appear to be anything he could do. Perhaps if I'd known that Vid had something to say on it, I'd have given him a call. But it's not... This is something I've come across before. You might have heard me talking about a friend of mine who ran a removal and storage business, which means he was running a small fleet of small vans, only three or four of them, and a warehouse for keeping things in. And pretty much the same thing happened to him. Turned out there was only one company with whom he could actually insure a small fleet of vehicles, and that meant his insurance was just being shoved through the roof. And as we know, again, especially from our chats with Mark Windows, but also with other people, there is a profound and dedicated attempt at knocking out the small businessman, preventing him from making his money, preventing him from doing the useful stuff that he does. You know, Jed was obviously really pleased each time he got a new piece of tackle for piercing his plastic bottles, or I don't know, for drying out his tin cans or whatever it was. Lots of specialist machinery, you know, 20 grand here, 30 grand there. You spend a long time working for it, saving up for it, you get it. You end up after 25 years with a pretty good thing, which they then make it impossible for you to run, and they sell all your tackle for hundreds of quid, whereas you bought it for tens of thousands. It's shocking, the whole bloody subject, really. And of course, one of the reasons why that's happened is because, presumably, as a result of the work of all of these guys over the years, like he said, he'd been at it since, I think, the late 80s, the techniques have been developed, the machinery's been developed, they've got machinery now where you can just tip the rubbish in at one end. There's a whole warehouse full of robot arms and lasers and whatever else it is that's needed, so that this machinery, this place with no people in it, can actually identify the seven different sorts of plastic and the steel from the aluminium and the dirty stuff from the clean stuff, and it just sorts it out a bit like one of those conveyors at a quarry or something, and drops it all into the right place, bales it up at the other end, and, as I said, more or less turns it out as money. So, shocking on all sorts of fronts, that one was, I thought. He's a really great guy. I'm sure he'll find something else to do. I don't know what Fire in the Mountain are going to be doing with their rubbish recycling next year. In fact, we might well ask ourselves, might we not, if the rubbish recycling plant's going to be in Swansea and it's going to shunt all of its stuff over to Holland, who is going to be doing the recycling at festivals and at other things? Because it's not, I mean, okay, I love music festivals. I like festivals where there's talks, like the kind of stuff we hear on people's internet radio, but there's lots of other festivals about. There's storytelling festivals where there's no need for security and things like that, but they're all going to be turning out shed loads of rubbish, and they're all going to be having a bit of a problem. If people like Jed's 8 or 9 man team that sorted their way through 9,600 bags of rubbish a week are no longer around, and if only corporate bodies are going to be collecting them. Pah! That's what I say. God. So, Jakey Z, not at the Fire in the Mountain Festival, but I chose to play one of his songs anyway. I'm going to carry on with that. Last year, when I did the Fire in the Mountain 2013 special, which was a 6-hour show, which this one won't be, you'll be grateful to hear, I'm sure. I worked it around so that I could play Rob Heron and the Teapad Orchestra in the show, because one of the venues at Fire in the Mountain is called Owl's World. It was in Owl's World that John Preston Tribute Band played, and Dark Patrick and one or two others of the people we're going to hear. And Al, who runs Owl's World, is the booking agent for Rob Heron. And as I was on my way out of the festival, he gave me their first album, which was called Money Isn't Everything. Most people who've listened to the show over the last year will know I've played it exhaustively, because it's got 10 or 11 tracks on it, and every single one of them is really cracking. Very danceable, very tight, really amazing musicianship, and fantastic lyrics as well, in my opinion. Now, as it happens, Rob Heron were actually on the bill to play at the Fire in the Mountain, and I think they would have gone down an absolute bloody storm, without a doubt. But a bit like the fact that John Preston forgot to pack his guitar player, or whatever. There was a little bit of difficulty with getting a member of the Rob Heron or the Teapad Orchestra along, and so it was that we didn't get to see any of them. So I'm going to leave the member of the band nameless, and I won't tell you what instrument he plays on this occasion, but hey, sort yourself out for next year. Get yourself to Fire in the Mountain. That's what I say. I want to see you. You'll have a really great time. Be a fine audience. However, as it happens, chatting with Al during this year's festival, I found that Rob Heron and the Teapad Orchestra have released a new album called Talking About the Weather. Very, very, very suitable. So, heading up the next two or three tunes, we've got Rob Heron and his Teapad Orchestra playing Junk on the Radio. I'm sure you'll all be sympathetic with that. So, here they come.
Well, the wireless seems somewhat tireless of playing me the same old humdrum, and the TV will not relieve me from sitting here twiddling my thumb. And I'd rather be listening to pots and pans or the solitary sound of a one-man band. Yeah, there's too much junk on the radio, too much trash on TV.
This man's got the antidote.
Yeah, well, I'm getting fatigued with all these frequencies churning out the same old tunes. And I feel patronized by what is advertised, telling me what to consume. Well, I'd rather be listening to pots and pans or the solitary sound of a one-man band. There's too much junk on the radio, too much trash on TV.
The deep blood.
propaganda.
Yes, sir.
Mixed up with a whole lot of lies and dirty slander. I'm gonna turn off my TV and my radio and form my own opinions from what I know now. Don't get me wrong, there's a lot of decent songs. It all just depends on what station you choose. And when it comes to TV, I know you won't believe me, but I'm probably telling more truths than the news.